about and committed to their jobs. Almost 20% are actively disengaged, the label Gallup uses to refer to employees who are not just unhappy at work, but are busy acting out their unhappiness. These are people who every day slowly undermine their organizations and the attitudes of their coworkers. The results of a study led by consulting firm Towers Watson portrayed an even bleaker situation. Only about 15% of employees, according to the findings of their research, are fully engaged. 65 to 70% of employees are moderately engaged, and 15% are totally disengaged. The global average is even worse, according to Gallup's 2016 survey. Across 142 countries, only 13% of workers feel engaged with their work. Disengagement is expensive. It hinders commitment, retention, productivity, and innovation. Engaged employees, Gallup finds, perform 20% better than their disengaged counterparts, and they are three times more creative. Gallup estimates that disengagement costs the American economy up to $550 billion per year in lost productivity. Companies with a highly engaged workforce, Google, say, or Recreational Equipment Inc., REI, are 22% more profitable and 21% more productive. They also have 37% lower absenteeism, 41% fewer defects, 48% fewer safety incidents, and lower turnover, 25% lower in high turnover organizations and 65% lower in low turnover companies. Particularly alarming is that the problem increases with growth. According to Gallup, employees in large companies are less engaged than those in smaller ones. Disengagement isn't just rampant at work. In a survey of nearly 1 million American K-12 students, Gallup found that only half consider themselves engaged, while 29% answered not engaged and 21% actively disengaged. The same problem plagues our personal lives. I recently conducted a survey of more than 1,000 people in the United States who reported being in a romantic or close relationship and found that over 80% felt the relationship was, more often than not, a cause for worry and frustration rather than energy and joy. We are facing a crisis of engagement in our lives. Can I pretend to have your attention for just a few moments? That's Marty Cobb, a Texas-based Southwest Airline flight attendant, launching into the safety announcement during a 2014 flight to Salt Lake City. My ex-husband, my new boyfriend, and their divorce attorney are going to show you the safety features of the Boeing 737-800 series, Cobb continues. It's been a long day for me. To properly fasten your seatbelt, slide the flap into the buckle. To release, lift up the buckle. Position your seatbelt tight and low across your hips, just like my grandmother wears her support bra. If you're traveling with small children, we're sorry, Cobb continues. If you're traveling with more than one child, pick out the one you think might have the most earning potential down the road. Passengers on the flight are giggling, which means they are paying attention. Cobb ends the announcement with a spin on the customary invitation. If there's anything at all we can do to make your flight more enjoyable, please tell us just as soon as we land in Salt Lake City. And if there's anything you can do to make our flight more enjoyable, we'll tell you immediately. We're not shy at Southwest. Cobb is not the only Southwest flight attendant who diverges from the standard announcement. David Holmes, a former computer programmer and personal trainer, became known as the rapping flight attendant after his performance on a 2009 Southwest flight to Las Vegas went viral. Sample rhyme, "We won't take your cash, you gotta pay with plastic. If you have a coupon, then that's fantastic." And Southwest flight attendant Jack Sullivan is known for impersonating Elvis, complete with sunglasses and scarves. When Colleen Barrett served as Southwest's executive vice president from 1990 to 2001, one of her priorities was to encourage workers to be themselves on the job. Unlike other airline executives, she didn't require employees to carefully follow scripts as long as they covered all the legally required information. To this day, Southwest encourages employees to welcome and entertain passengers in their own authentic ways. The company's recruiting and hiring practices were created based on the belief that authenticity and humor help people thrive during times of change, stay creative even when under pressure, work with greater energy, and remain healthy in the process. This philosophy has helped the company achieve high passenger volume, profitability, and customer satisfaction. Southwest has low turnover and a near-perfect safety record. Barrett has said, "We have always thought that your avocation can be your vocation, so that you don't have to do any acting in your life when you leave home to go to work." What Southwest has created is a workplace where engagement is high. In a context in which routine can trap employees in mindless repetition, Southwest leadership respects human nature and allows employees to decide how to best do their work, so long as what they do is aligned with the company's main objective, safety for everyone. With this approach, it's not just the employees who stay engaged. The passengers do, too. Engagement can do great things for employees, leaders, and organizations. When we are committed to the organization and energized by our work, productivity is supercharged, ideas are more creative, relationships are stronger, the organization is more successful, and customers are more likely to be satisfied with the company's products and services. I still smile when I think about a comment I once heard from a Southwest flight attendant after a landing. "As you exit the plane, please make sure to gather all of your belongings. Anything left behind will be distributed evenly among the flight attendants. Please do not leave children or spouses." We all delight in being engaged. It's so much better to start a flight with a rap than it is to hear the same tedious announcement we've been subjected to many times before. One of the funny things about human nature, though, is that we tend to succumb to habits like conformity that aren't good for us. We are social animals with a strong desire to be accepted by others, and conformity gives us comfort. But it also reduces our level of engagement, whether in our jobs or in our relationships. Except for the most rebellious among us, we have a strong preference for the status quo. In an organization, this preference can lead to various standard practices that may play an important role in day-to-day operations, but that can also leave us feeling stuck and make everyone around us feel stuck. The annals of business are full of tales of companies that struggled to keep their workforce motivated in the long term and ended up with employees who were either frustrated or checked out. When Doug Conant became president and CEO of Campbell's Soup Company in 2001, he arrived at corporate headquarters in Camden to find that the parking lots were surrounded by barbed wire, the walls needed a paint job, and the floors needed new carpets. Campbell's had been struggling financially, and the problems had taken a toll on everyone. Employees described headquarters to Conant as a prison. It had been clear that the company was in serious trouble since the end of the 1990s, when senior management had raised prices and sales began falling as a result. By 2001, Campbell's share price had sunk to half of the high it had reached in November 1998. To correct the error made by raising prices, Campbell's management cut costs, slashing advertising spending and laying off about 400 employees. As Conant noted, "They had to cut costs to the point where they were literally taking the chicken out of chicken noodle soup, and the product was no longer competitive." The downward spiral continued. The pride that employees had once taken in working for Campbell's also suffered. The company started in 1869 and grew steadily over the years. By the early 1970s, it had gone international and become one of the largest food companies in the world. In the United States, the Campbell's brand turned iconic, as Andy Warhol signaled with his pop art soup cans. Many Americans could hum the "mm-mm good" advertising jingle. A bowl of Campbell's tomato soup, one of the firm's best-selling products, and a grilled cheese sandwich had become quintessential comfort food, almost as American as baseball and apple pie. Soon after arriving, Conant announced that his top priority was to increase employee engagement. Many company executives scoffed, believing that Campbell's faced more pressing issues. Rather than investing in its people, some doubters said, the company would be better off continuing to cut costs. Other critics believed the company had to invest in its product portfolio and marketing efforts. But in Conant's words, the firm had a very toxic culture. The management system had gone off the rails, and employee morale was abysmal. To turn around the company's prospects, Conant believed he needed to start with its 20,000 employees. The problems Conant saw in the company's workforce were confirmed by the results of a survey he asked Gallup to conduct in 2002. The goal was to assess the level of personal commitment employees felt toward the company and its goals. The survey results were dismal, among the worst Gallup had ever seen in Fortune 500 companies. More than 60% of Campbell's employees reported they were not engaged in their work, and over 10% reported that they were actively disengaged. That is, they were so unhappy at work that they were actively undermining the efforts of the few people who were actually performing. As for those in top management positions, over 40% operated in a state of being tuned out, with little interest in contributing to the company's work and goals. To take action, Conant first got moving, literally. He wore a pedometer on his belt and put on a pair of walking shoes, whether at the company's New Jersey headquarters or at production plants in Europe and Asia. He set the goal of logging 10,000 steps each day and having meaningful interactions with as many employees as possible. Conant also introduced a series of meetings he called one-over-ones, so named to convey a sense that everyone was in it together. These meetings began with a regular review between an employee and his or her manager. Then the employee and manager would be invited in to meet with Conant and the head of human resources. The conversation was purposely kept informal and candid. Both the manager and their direct report could ask questions, discuss whatever issues were on their minds, and propose ideas. In fact, they were encouraged to do so. The meetings gave managers and employees the opportunity to approach the CEO with any question or idea. By including four people rather than the usual two that are present in a performance review, one-over-ones extended the reach of the discussion. Conant and the head of HR got access to more information than they would have by only talking to their direct reports. And at the same time, the CEO's vision made its way down throughout the company. These two initiatives, Conant's walks and the one-over-ones conversations, showed employees that they were truly valued. Conant also started sending out personalized notes, up to 20 per day, thanking employees for their successes and specific contributions. He spent about an hour each day writing these notes by hand. A staffer helped him find success stories he could thank employees for at all levels of Campbell's. Why handwritten notes? Because more than half of the workforce didn't use a computer. In his 10 years with the company, Conant sent more than 30,000 handwritten thank yous, which recipients hung in their offices or above their desks. Conant had the razor wire surrounding the building removed and the weeds and overgrowth cleared. He had estate fencing installed and the curbs painted. Then he started to fix the inside of the building, updates to the carpet, decor, and paint. Conant wanted to give employees visible signs of a turnaround, a better future for themselves and for the organization. To reinvigorate employees, Conant believed, the company needed to eliminate barriers, whether razor wire or departmental silos that held back ideas and conversation. As a result of Conant's changes, employees were happier. Performance and retention started to improve. Engagement started to rise. And now that the employees were more fired up for the workday, they offered ideas that improved product quality and led to innovations, like easy-to-open pop-top cans and new shelving systems for supermarkets that would help customers find the soup they wanted. At the management level, Conant was ruthless. According to Gallup's research over the years, managers are key to building and maintaining employee engagement. When people quit, in fact, they're not quitting their jobs, they're quitting their bosses. Managers account for at least 70% of the variance in employee engagement. In Conant's first 3 years, he pushed out over 300 of the company's top 350 leaders. To replace those who had been fired, he promoted about 150 people from within, and for the rest he brought in high-performance leaders from other companies. By 2009, Campbell's was doing much better than the S&P Food Group and the S&P 500. Between 2001 and 2011, the company's total sales and revenue grew about 24%. The revenues of Standard & Poor's 500 firms declined nearly 10% on average in the same period. Both analysts on Wall Street and investors gave Conant full credit for Campbell's turnaround. From a psychological perspective, Conant became a model of how to inspire employees and release their talents by bringing to the company three ingredients of employer engagement: dedication, absorption, and vigor. In his walkabouts and in the one-over-ones, the CEO made employees feel that their work and contributions to the organization were valued. It was clear that he cared about their development and their satisfaction. When we feel that the work we do matters, our dedication deepens. The changes Conant made to the physical environment removed distractions so that employees could focus on their jobs. When the attention is focused, we reach a state of absorption and time passes quickly. The handwritten notes also likely made a difference. When we receive expressions of gratitude, my research shows, we are more likely to persist when the road gets tough. As energy and mental resilience increase, we experience vigor. Bring together dedication, absorption, and vigor, and employees are highly engaged. When Gallup surveyed Campbell's employees in 2009, the results were quite different than they had been in 2002. 68% said they were actively engaged by their work, and only 3% reported being actively disengaged. Conant proved that employee engagement had been the main problem at Campbell's and the key to a turnaround. Think about the times when you've most felt engaged. Maybe you were attending a concert and found your mind bouncing with creative ideas, captivated by the music. Perhaps you sat down at your desk and started writing after attending an inspiring lecture. Maybe you struck up a conversation with a stranger on the subway and felt like you could have talked for days. When we are engaged, our happiness, our outside-the-box thinking, and our productivity all increase, and the organizations we work for benefit as well. In one field study my colleagues and I conducted at Morningstar, the tomato processing company in California, we asked harvesters to watch a short video in which a colleague told them about the positive impact their work had in the factory. Then we surveyed Morningstar employees, and those who had seen the video indicated feeling more engaged at work than those who hadn't seen it. Their productivity was also higher. They achieved a 7% increase per hour in tons of tomatoes harvested in the weeks after watching the video. In a follow-up study, a similar message not only increased participants' engagement and performance, but also their creativity. For organizations, lack of employee engagement negatively affects quality, productivity, customer satisfaction, and financial outcomes. According to a study by Dale Carnegie Training, for instance, billions of dollars are lost each year to employee turnover, and companies with engaged employees outperform those with employees who report lack of engagement by over 200%. Lack of employee engagement is linked to higher healthcare costs and lost productivity, according to Gallup. The positive effects of being engaged extend beyond the workplace. College students who report feeling engaged have been shown to be more likely to pass their exams. When students are energized by what they are learning, they perform better academically. In close relationships, engagement and passion lead to longer commitments, greater happiness and satisfaction, and a stronger willingness to work together in the face of adversity. In parenting, engagement leads to greater trust between parents and children, greater commitment to the family, and more joy in family dynamics. In this book, I've introduced you to the talents that we see again and again in rebels: novelty, curiosity, perspective, diversity, and authenticity. What is fascinating, though, is what binds all these talents together. They are all paths to engagement. The talent for novelty allows us to fight the boredom that comes with routines and traditions. The talent for curiosity allows us to combat the tendency to stick with the status quo. The talent for perspective allows us to rebel against our narrow focus when we approach problems or decisions, which usually includes only one view, our own. The talent for diversity allows us to defy the stereotypes that are so ingrained in human nature. The talent for authenticity allows us to be honest about our preferences, emotions, and beliefs. At their core, rebels are engaged. They have abundant energy and mental resilience. They invest in their work and in their personal relationships, and they persist even when the road gets tough. They feel inspired by and passionate about what they do and who they know, and they inspire those around them. Thanks to their engagement, rebels are successful. And yet, as individuals and as members of organizations, we struggle to understand how to boost engagement. Doug Conant arrived at a failing soup company and successfully turned it around by walking the floors, repainting the walls, having honest conversations with his staff, and saying thank you again and again. Yet this is not the only way of achieving engagement and reaping its many benefits. A green-skinned alien with three eyes, three-fingered hands, and an oblong head with pointy ears and a single club-tipped antenna stared up at me from the ID badge I'd been given to wear for the day. My name appeared on the badge alongside a warning, "A stranger from the outside." It was a sunny spring day in 2017 in Emeryville, California, north of the Bay Area, and I was at Pixar Animation Studios, a large complex with baseball and soccer fields, lush gardens, a 600-seat amphitheater, tennis courts, and a swimming pool. At the heart of the campus is the two-story Steve Jobs Building, 218,000 square feet of space for hundreds of people to work, eat, and play. After being ousted from Apple in 1985, Jobs bought Pixar, which was called Graphics Group at the time, from Lucasfilm, and remained the firm's largest shareholder and CEO until Disney acquired the company in 2006. In front of the Jobs Building stands a statue of the company's mascot, Luxo Jr., a desk lamp with human emotions from Pixar's first short film created in 1986. Jobs oversaw the construction of the building from the smallest details to the big picture. It was Jobs who came up with the idea of having a very large atrium that every Pixar employee would have to pass through each day, enabling random encounters and conversations. The atrium, built with a mixture of steel and brick for an industrial feel, has lots of natural light, life-size versions of Pixar characters, and a display case for the company's multiple Oscars, Golden Globes, and Annie Awards. The building's decor changes regularly to feature whatever Pixar film is coming out that year and to showcase off-screen employee artwork. The Jobs Building also houses Pixar's main restaurant, Café Luxo, which offers wood-fire pizza, a burrito bar, daily specials, and free fountain drinks. The building also has a mailroom, a free cereal bar, a gift shop, and plenty of lounging areas. The only bathrooms on the first floor of the building are in the atrium, a compromise from Jobs, who reportedly suggested at one point that the atrium's floor have the only bathrooms for the whole main building. Having only one set of restrooms creates more opportunities for people to run into one another, ask questions, and exchange ideas. In 2016, I had become interested in visiting Pixar after meeting Ed Catmull, a co-founder and the company's president. Pixar has had an unprecedented run of highly acclaimed, successful movies. Yet, as Catmull explained to me when we first met, Pixar probably has about the same failure rate as other studios. The difference, in his mind, is that the failed Pixar films were not released. He listed other Pixar films that had drastically changed over time. In Ratatouille, for instance, only a single line from the initial script made it into the final version of the film. In its first version, Up was about a floating castle in the sky. Catmull described the revisions that took place on the subsequent incarnations of the film, saying, "The only thing that was left was the bird and the word up. In the next version, there was a house that floated up and landed on a lost Russian dirigible. In the next version, the bird laid eggs that conferred long life." No Pixar movie ever starts out as well-written, funny, and heartfelt as what we see in the theaters. Each one goes through all sorts of changes along the way. Rather than calling these digressions failures, Catmull describes them as just things that we tried. Along with animated filmmaking, Pixar has mastered the art of engagement. The company's movies appeal to audiences of all ages, from children to adults. A child may laugh at the unexpected roles that characters take on, like toys that talk, while an adult may be impressed by the ability of the writers to cover complex topics with humor, or by the sheer ingenuity of it all. Pixar movies touch a wide audience, captivating viewers from beginning to end. What is it about Pixar storytelling that keeps everyone so engaged? And what might the rest of us learn? The studio is one of the most successful in the world, with 15 Academy Awards and an average international gross of over $600 million per film. Moreover, unconventional plots and ideas are in the company's DNA. The Pixar universe includes a world of talking cars, an elderly man whose house floats to South America thanks to thousands of balloons, Up, a rat who wants to be a chef, Ratatouille, and the emotions residing in a young girl's brain, Inside Out. I watched every single Pixar movie again before visiting the campus and was glued to my seat, at times laughing out loud. I was struck by how fully transporting the stories are. But even the best storytellers may not get engagement right on the first try. Meet Pete Docter, the director of Monsters, Inc., Up, and Inside Out. Docter, who started working at Pixar in 1989 when he was 21, the day after he graduated from college, comes across as a cartoon character himself. He's impossibly tall, with a reed-thin torso, bendy arms, and eyes full of wonder. His colleagues once compared his narrow head to a pencil eraser. After starting at Pixar with limited responsibilities, Docter soon began to take on larger roles in writing, animation, sound recording, and music. As one of the three key screenwriters behind the concept of Toy Story, he created Buzz Lightyear partially in his own image, pausing to check the mirror while he drew the character. Next, he was charged with directing Monsters, Inc. Not only would this be his directorial debut, but he would be only the second person to direct a Pixar film after Pixar co-founder and chief creative officer John Lasseter had helmed the first three. Monsters, Inc. is set in a factory run by two monsters, James P. Sully Sullivan and Mike Wazowski, whose work involves generating the screams of frightened children, which are needed to power the monster universe. With his blue fur, large frame, and leonine roar, Sully, voiced by John Goodman, comes from a generation of kid scarers. His best friend and coach, Mike, voiced by Billy Crystal, is a lime-green, potato-shaped monster with one all-seeing eye. Monsters who scare kids for a living, Docter thought, was a promising hook for engaging an audience. But at an early test screening, viewers began checking their watches about 15 minutes into the movie. Disaster. This was a difficult time for Docter, personally. For years, he had been single-mindedly devoted to Pixar. But he had recently become a father and found himself focusing on something other than work. He felt a great emotional connection to his son, Nick, the little creature who had entered his life, and wanted to make sure he took good care of him. As he struggled to figure out how to fix his movie, Docter had a key insight. Sully, too, needed someone to care for. Sully was focused solely on his career, and the audience was having trouble empathizing with him. Revising the story, Docter introduced Boo, a pigtailed 2-year-old girl with big brown eyes and dark brown hair, whom Sully saves from the clutches of his and Mike's biggest rival, Randall. Over the course of the revised movie, Sully and Boo grow ever closer as Sully and Mike help her out of one tight spot after another, all the while trying to evade Randall. At one point in the movie, Boo runs away and is captured by Randall, who tries to use her in an experiment to forcibly extract screams for the growing energy crisis. But Sully comes to the rescue. As he transforms from being all work and no play to caring for Boo, Sully becomes a character audiences can relate to. The most engaging stories have this type of deep emotional core. As a main character faces challenges, he reacts to them in authentic ways and exposes his vulnerabilities. The character might not be totally sympathetic, but if his reactions and emotions seem real, the audience will begin to care deeply about what happens to him, almost as if his story is their own. Doctor told me, the main character is like a surrogate for you, the audience member. They're learning and discovering information at the same time you are, so that by the time the film ends, you feel like you've gone on the same emotional journey the character has. As the doctor sees it, Sully's emotional connection to Boo saved the movie, both at the box office and in the eyes of critics. This same idea, emotional connection, can be used to spark engagement at work. At Campbell's, Conant created an emotional connection with his employees by getting to know them and celebrating their contributions. Or consider the analytics software giant SAS, whose founder and CEO, Jim Goodnight, promotes emotional engagement by giving workers plenty of freedom. When people are free to make choices at work, they feel more authentic and in control, my research finds. Employees often welcome this sense of freedom as a true gift, as it makes them look at their relationship with the organization as emotional rather than just transactional. At SAS, it's not uncommon to see employees at the company gym long after the traditional lunch hour, or to see Goodnight himself getting a haircut on campus in the middle of the afternoon. Stories, as Pixar understands them, become memorable in a way that resonates with people when they appeal to some fundamental truth about human nature, even if monsters, clownfish, robots, or cars are standing in for humans. Think back to a recent movie or novel that moved you. What triggered your emotions? The magic typically happens when we see a character's vulnerabilities or imperfections. When a story feels authentic, we connect. Similarly, in organizations, we feel engaged when we are encouraged to be authentic by leaders who exhibit the same freedom. Organizations can encourage employees to bring more of themselves to work in small and big ways. At Pixar, for example, animators can decorate their office space however they like. The result? One animator's space is decorated like a tiki cabin. Another has a second floor built on top of the first. And several cubicle-like spaces have been converted into tiny duplex houses. The whimsical decorating is actually beside the point. It's what it says about the people who work there, the freedom they feel, and the relationships, real emotional relationships, they build. Pixar president and co-founder Ed Catmull has a large, bright workspace on the second floor of the Steve Jobs building. Windows overlook green lawns, and toy versions of characters from my favorite Pixar movies fill the shelves of his office. When we met, Catmull sat on a couch in his office across from me, dressed in a colorful short-sleeve shirt and jeans. He told me that, despite all the signs of comfort and whimsy I saw around me, Pixar had experienced real trouble. In 2013, 7 years after being acquired by Disney, the studio had gone through some tough times. Film budgets were rising, the DVD market was shrinking, and production costs were soaring. Pixar management was also increasingly feeling that a key aspect of the company culture, employees' willingness to speak their minds freely, was not what it used to be. Catmull said, "A hallmark of a healthy creative culture is that its people feel free to share ideas, opinions, and criticisms." He went on to note that when a creative group draws on unvarnished perspectives of all its members and the collective knowledge, decision-making stands to benefit. Candor is a key to effective collaboration, says Catmull. He told me, lack of candor leads to dysfunctional environments. This belief has been at the core of Pixar's culture since the company was founded. At its inception, Pixar formed a group called the Brain Trust, which consisted of 4 or 5 Pixar creative leaders who oversee development on all movies, meeting every few months to assess progress and challenges. Catmull described the Brain Trust in simple terms, saying, "Put smart, passionate people in a room together, charge them with identifying and solving problems, and encourage them to be candid." The whole idea behind the Brain Trust is that members should speak freely, arguing without fear of conflict, with the interests of the company in mind. The group has no authority, so when members evaluate a movie in production, the director can decide whether or not to follow any of their specific suggestions. In the 2010s, Pixar was expanding and growing, so it hired more and more people. The new recruits were excited, sure, but the talent in the room was usually pretty intimidating, and left them nervous about sharing their own ideas. Executives decided to try something bold to improve the situation. In early 2013, Catmull and a few other managers began planning a special day, Notes Day, during which Pixar would shut down to elicit honest feedback from its employees. Notes Day was an expansion of the spirit of the Brain Trust. Catmull and other executives at Pixar wanted to bring the same style of safe sharing to the entire organization. For Notes Day, employees were invited to brainstorm ways to improve the company, drawing on topics and problems they themselves had identified. So that employees would feel comfortable offering candid feedback, managers were excluded from Notes Day. Notes Day was inspired by a widespread practice among studios of screening in-progress films for executives who offer written suggestions and criticisms, or notes. At most studios, directors are generally encouraged, if not required, to follow the directions of these notes. But Pixar decided to handle notes differently. All employees are invited to screenings at the very early stages of a film, long before a storyline is finalized, and everyone is welcome to give notes. Moreover, directors do not have to use the notes they receive. The notes are merely suggestions. Pixar's version of the practice is more like crowdsourcing. Notes Day applied the same principles to the overall practices of the company, as opposed to a specific film. One initial goal of Notes Day was to solicit ideas from employees on how to lower costs by 10%. Pixar executives asked employees to prepare themselves for Notes Day by imagining they'd been transported 4 years into the future, and to answer the following questions. The year is 2017. Both of this year's films were completed well under budget. What innovations helped these productions meet their budget goals? What are some of the specific things we did differently? Questions were sent out to all employees, generating over 4,000 responses on more than 1,000 unique topics, such as reducing implicit gender bias in Pixar films, shortening production time, and improving the workplace. Out of the thousands of responses, executives chose 106 issues for employees to discuss in separate sessions. The sessions were spread across three buildings on Pixar's main campus, and employees could choose for themselves which sessions to attend. Trained internal facilitators led each session, which culminated with specific proposals, brainstorms, or best practices. The group also assigned certain members to be their idea advocates, those who would help advance their suggestions. After identifying their recommendation, employees were treated to hot dogs and beer. Out of the 106 topics, the company immediately started working on 21. Some were small changes, like implementing a faster, more secure way of delivering film cuts to directors. But even the smallest changes added up to something bigger. Catmull said, they were changing Pixar, meaningfully and for the better. And improving efficiency may not have been the most notable benefit. Catmull writes in his book, Creativity, Inc., I believe the biggest payoff of Notes Day was that we made it safer for people to say what they thought. Notes Day made it okay to disagree. In the years that followed, Pixar saw the benefits of its Notes Day candor. It released two successful films in 2015, Inside Out and The Good Dinosaur, then Finding Dory in 2016, followed by Cars 3 and Coco in 2017. Inside Out was one of Pixar's most successful movies, with an adjusted net profit of about $689 million and the best opening weekend of all time for a film using an original idea rather than existing characters. The company, Catmull told me, has always recognized that conflict is a key aspect of creativity. With a smile, Catmull told me a story about the late Steve Jobs, Pixar's chairman, a story Catmull also recounts in detail in his book Creativity, Inc. Catmull once asked Jobs what happened when people working with him disagreed with his point of view. Jobs' answer was simple, I just explain it to them until they understand. Though their relationship was no different in nature, Catmull developed a clever solution to voice his opinions. In the 26 years they worked together, Catmull told me that he and Jobs never had an angry argument, but they did disagree quite often. He told me, I would say something and Jobs would immediately shoot it down because he could think faster than I could. Catmull would then wait about a week or so and reach out to Jobs. He said, I'd call and give my counterargument and he'd shoot it down again. Catmull would wait another week and call again. He told me, sometimes this would go on for months. In the end, Jobs would say, oh, I get it, you're right, or I would realize he was right. And the rest of the time, we didn't reach consensus. He'd just let me do it my way and wouldn't say anything more about it. Jobs had a reputation for being difficult and demanding, and no one would say he was an expert in conflict resolution. Catmull clearly had to work hard to make sure his boss heard his voice. But it's notable that neither Jobs nor Catmull took the disagreements personally or allowed them to create barriers to collaboration. In the creative process, tension and conflict need to be embraced for good ideas to emerge. A sense of conflict triggers exploration of novel ideas. For instance, the sense of disorientation and conflict people experience when reading a short story that seems absurd has been shown to enhance their desire to learn novel information. People experiencing conflict have been found to generate more original solutions to difficult situations than individuals who are in a more cooperative mood. Similarly, when members of a team experience conflict, they tend to scrutinize and deeply explore alternatives, which leads them to novel insights. In my own research, I find that when people are asked to meet goals that appear to be at odds, for example, create an original product cheaply, their ideas are more innovative than when they have to meet only one of those goals. When people disagree constructively, their ideas improve. At Ariel Investments, the Chicago money management firm, constructive dissent is actively encouraged by assigning devil's advocates to meetings and other dialogues. The devil's advocate is charged with poking holes in the decision-making process. During the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, the devil's advocate became a key feature of Ariel's research process. One person would follow a stock, another was instructed to argue the opposite. Each person tried to represent their opinion constructively while being open to debate. Melody Hobson, the company's president, regularly opens team meetings with a reminder to those attending it. They don't have to be right. Rather, they simply need to voice concerns and be willing to disagree to help the team make the right decisions. Most of us fear conflict, and understandably so. Conflict stirs up negative emotions and makes us feel vulnerable. But when expressed constructively, conflict allows us to explore new possibilities, arrive at surprising solutions, and gain important insights into ourselves and others. Without conflict, there would be no Pixar movies. How could there be a Finding Nemo without Nemo getting lost? Up would lose its power if 78-year-old balloon salesman Carl Fredrickson, the main character, hadn't lost his wife and grown bitter. Insights and innovations seldom arise when we're feeling satisfied with the status quo. Rather, they come from the energy that's created when we crave change. In storytelling and organizations, as well as in our personal lives, conflict leads to engagement. Different perspectives work to heighten our attention. Rebels embrace tension and conflict. Catmull told me, ideas only become great when they are challenged and tested. The right amount of conflict makes for a good story and a more rewarding life. In 1996, Pixar started working on the sequel to Toy Story, the studio's first full-length picture. At the time, Pixar's second feature, A Bug's Life, was still in production. As Catmull recounts in a Harvard Business Review article on how Pixar encourages creativity, the company had enough technicians to mount a second project, but its proven creative leaders, those who succeeded with Toy Story, were busy finishing their work on A Bug's Life. So a new creative team was put in charge, made up of people who had never run a film production. The original concept for the sequel seemed solid. Woody, a cowboy doll, is excitedly anticipating a trip to cowboy camp. Finally, he'll have quality time alone with Andy, the boy who owns him. Woody is one of Andy's favorite toys. At the same time, Woody is worried about what will happen to the considerably less responsible toys in Andy's room while he's gone. But these worries are forgotten when Woody faces a major crisis. His arm is ripped, and the injury keeps him from going to cowboy camp. Another crisis soon follows. A toy collector kidnaps Woody and takes him to his apartment, where a new group of toys is introduced. Among them is a cowgirl named Jessie, a horse named Bullseye, and a mint-quality doll named Stinky Pete. They explain to Woody that they are all toys based on Woody's Roundup, a TV show from the 1940s and 1950s. Now that Woody has joined them, the Woody's Roundup toys can all be sold to a museum in Japan, doomed to spend the rest of their lives separated from children by thick glass. As part of the process of making an animated movie, storyboards are drawn early on, and these initial storyboards are then edited together with dialogue and music that is only temporary. These make up the story reels, as they are called in the business, which are typically rough but help illuminate problems that need to be solved in the film. Next come new versions of the reels, each typically improving on the previous one. But that was not the case for Toy Story 2. The initial idea was creative enough, but the reels were not getting better. By the time Pixar began animation, the reels were not where they needed to be. Catmull writes, "Making matters worse, the directors and producers were not pulling together to rise to the challenge." The problem was that the story was too predictable. It did not allow the audience to imagine what might happen next. At a key moment in the story, Woody faces an important decision, whether to leave his home to travel to Japan or attempt an escape from the collector's apartment and go back to Andy. As Toy Story fans well know, Woody and Andy have a deep connection. After all, Woody is Andy's favorite toy. This makes Woody's choice too predictable. Clearly, he'll want to go back home to be with Andy. When viewers can predict how the story will unfold, there's no drama and they will disengage. Pixar faced the challenge of introducing unpredictability, that is, making the audience come to the realization that Woody had a tough decision to make and it was unclear which option he would choose. But the team working on the movie was unable to come up with a solution to the challenge. Luckily, the team working on A Bug's Life finished up in time to take over the leadership driving the creative efforts for Toy Story 2. They were now on a very tight deadline, as the release date for the sequel could not be moved. Having 18 months to work on the film would have been an aggressive schedule. At that point, only 8 months were left for the job. They created a scene called Jessie's Story, in which Jessie, a cowgirl doll, sings an emotional song to Woody to explain why she does not want to escape, but rather is willing to go to Japan. In the song called When She Loved Me, Jessie reveals that she had been the favorite doll of a young girl, but once the girl grew up, she got rid of her. Jessie is convinced that losing someone you love is far worse than never having known that person in the first place. By going to Japan, she believes, Woody can avoid the heartache of being discarded by Andy when he grows up. And then there's the sad story of Stinky Pete. Left behind on a shelf with no chance to ever play with a child, he would also prefer to be in a museum. After all, at least he'd have a long life. Plus, as Jessie and Stinky Pete make clear, if Woody returns to Andy and his friends, he dooms the Woody's Roundup toys to life inside the collector's dark boxes, as he wouldn't ship them to Japan except as a set. All of us can relate to the fears that grip Woody and his new friends. Suddenly, Woody's choice is no longer predictable, and the audience is engaged. When a Pixar movie starts, it's difficult to predict where it's going or how it will end. This is true of the most engaging stories in general. They are full of surprises. Doctor gave me an example of creating surprises and unpredictability from Toy Story. At some point in the film, the creative team wanted to make use of the rocket strapped to Buzz Lightyear's back. But they wanted to do so in a way that was unexpected and surprising to the audience. Sid, a boy living next door to Andy's house, is rather sadistic as he enjoys torturing toys. For instance, in one scene of the film, Sid puts a mask on as if he were a surgeon and starts operating on his sister's doll. He ends up removing the doll's head and replacing it with that of another toy, and then he returns the mutilated doll to his sister, saying, "All better now." Once the surgery is over, Buzz observes, "I don't believe that man's ever been to medical school." Buzz and Woody are trapped at Sid's, though, and have to devise an escape plan. By that point, Sid had taped Buzz to a fat firecracker, as he was planning to blow him up, as he'd done with other toys. Earlier, Sid had tried to burn Woody on the grill, so Woody, being close to fire, had put a match in his holster. The storytellers thought the match could be used to light the firecracker on Buzz's back and bring Woody and Buzz flying back home. But they realized that the audience would see that coming. So instead, Woody lights the match, only to have it blown out by a passing car. All seems lost, until Woody remembers the power of the sun. He uses the reflection of Buzz's helmet to light the fuse, and off they go. Organizations can use unpredictability to improve engagement. The thank you notes at Campbell's both surprised and motivated employees. As another example, an HBS study of the freelancer contracting site Odesk, now renamed Upwork, found that surprise incentives resulted in greater employee effort than higher pay. Harvard Business School researchers posted a data entry job on Odesk that would take 4 hours. One of the postings offered $3 per hour for the job, the other offered $4 per hour. People with past data entry experience were hired at either the $3 or $4 rate. But some of those who were initially told they'd be paid $3 were later told that the hiring company had a bigger budget than what they expected. Therefore, they said, "We will pay you $4 per hour instead of $3 per hour." The group initially hired at $4 an hour worked no harder than those hired at $3. But those who received the surprise raise worked substantially harder than the other two groups. And among those with experience, their effort more than made up for the cost of the extra pay. Surprises quench our thirst for the new and feed our curiosity, making us wonder what could happen next. At the end of my day at Pixar, I walked past the desk where I had picked up my badge and smiled at the Buzz Lightyear statue. The people who created him and characters like him had held my attention all day. I didn't want to leave. When we are engaged, time flies, and life and work take on a different, deeper meaning. The passion and engagement of the Pixar employees I'd observed that day reminded me of a story I once read about President Kennedy visiting NASA back in 1962. This was not long after his famous speech about going to the moon, at the height of the Cold War. He saw a janitor who he noticed was fully immersed in his work, sweeping the room the president was touring. "Hi, I am Jack Kennedy," the president said to him. "What are you doing here?" Without any hesitation, the janitor gave him an answer. "I'm helping put a man on the moon, Mr. President." Chapter 8, Becoming a Rebel Leader, Blackbeard, Flatness, and the 8 Principles of Rebel Leadership. Every man shall have an equal vote in affairs of the moment. First article in the Constitution governing the pirate ship of the legendary Black Bart. In the deep heat of an early 18th century summer, a crew of pirates was sailing off the Virginia coast when a lookout spotted a merchant ship to the south. The pirates launched their attack, rocking the merchant ship with a cascade of musket balls and grenades. When a wounded helmsman abandoned the merchant ship's wheel, the vessel swung around, drifting out of control. The pirates boarded, swinging axes and cutlasses. Behind them came the captain, his face clouded by smoke. Sashes holding daggers and pistols crisscrossed his large chest. Black ribbons flapped in his braided beard. The most feared pirate of his era had taken another ship. Blackbeard was a notorious English raider who terrorized sailors around the West Indies and North America in the early 1700s. Sometimes he plotted sneak attacks, sometimes he relied on trickery, such as flying the home flag of the targeted ship before hoisting his own at the very last moment. After first targeting the man at the wheel, the pirates would snare their quarry with grappling hooks, pull it closer, and leap aboard. When the attack was over, they made hostages of the passengers and crew and went through the cabins looking for gold, silver, and jewelry. We usually associate pirates with violence, theft, and mayhem. That's all true, but their ships were also forward-looking in a number of surprising and instructive ways. On the open sea, a merchant ship was a floating dictatorship. With the blessing of the vessel's owner, the captain treated crewmen as he saw fit, often harshly. Sailors were beaten, overworked, underpaid, and sometimes starved. Morale was low. Dissent was punished as mutiny. Pirates, by contrast, practiced a revolutionary form of democracy. To keep the ship running smoothly for months on end and to discourage revolt, pirates elected their captain democratically, limited his power, and guaranteed crew members a say in the ship's affairs. They also elected a quartermaster who, in addition to his primary duties, settling minor disputes and distributing supplies and money, served as a check against the captain's authority. Except in the heat of battle, when the captain took full command, no one man ruled the others. Captain and crew took a vote on everything, where to go, from whom to steal, how to steal it, where to go next, the fate of prisoners. With enough votes, the crew could demote or even dismiss the captain. They could maroon him on an island or dump him into the sea. And when the rules were disputed, it was a jury of crewmen who decided the matter, not the captain. As Bob Dylan sings in Absolutely Sweet Marie, to live outside the law, you must be honest. Any pirate could lodge complaints or concerns without fear of reprisal, as crew members were protected by articles, essentially a constitution drafted for each ship. The articles were democratically formed and required unanimous agreement before an expedition launched. They set the rights and duties of the crew, rules for handling of disputes, and incentives and insurance payments to ensure bravery in battle. Pirate ships developed highly detailed schemes to compensate injured crewmen. That the crew elected and could depose their leaders stood in dramatic contrast to the tyrannical rule common on most merchant vessels. After capturing a ship, raiders would ask their prisoners if they might want to switch sides. Given the relative freedom and power that pirates enjoyed, and the spirit of anti-authoritarianism and self-governance characterizing their endeavors, it was not uncommon for merchant sailors to seize the opportunity. As they sailed the high seas, pirates picked up mariners from different races, religions, and ethnicities, which made for a cosmopolitan lot. The democratic nature of the ships and the pirates' defiance of custom meant blacks were welcomed as equals. Slavery was easy to find on the mainland, but at sea, black pirates had the right to vote, were entitled to an equal share of the booty, could bear arms, and were even elected captains of crews that were predominantly white. The goal was competent, hard-working deckhands. Skin color didn't matter. Pirates even raided slave plantations and ships for better crews. Blackbeard's ship was arguably more democratic than America was at the time. Historian Marcus Redeker writes, "Pirates constructed a world in defiant contradistinction to the ways of the world they left behind." There's another surprising detail about Blackbeard, whose real name was Edward Teach. Yes, he braided his beard and tied the braids with black ribbons. Yes, he stuffed slow-burning rope under his hat to make himself look more menacing. Yes, he had a reputation as a ruthless cutthroat. But Blackbeard did not kill a single man during his career at sea. He captured other sailors, but did not take their lives. The image he cultivated for himself and his crew was a brilliant bit of 18th-century marketing that won him glory and riches, and did not require the loss of lives. Back in the 1950s, the social psychologist Robert Freed Bales ran an experiment in which he divided a cohort of college students into groups of 3 to 7 members. He was interested in studying group interactions. The groups, which had no appointed leader, met for several hours to make decisions and solve assigned problems. The students didn't know one another, but they had something in common. They were all men in their sophomore year at Harvard. Despite the initial lack of group structure and the fact that the members were very much alike, Bales repeatedly found that a hierarchy developed smoothly and quickly in each group, often within minutes. It would arise from simple behaviors such as how much people talked, which signaled status, influence, and good ideas. Bale's results suggest that even when members seem to be of equal status, hierarchies based on status, the respect, influence, and prominence that members enjoy in the eyes of others, take shape. Across the globe, groups and organizations rely on some form of social hierarchy to instill order and efficiency. In groups, leaders naturally emerge from interactions, and a few central